I can eat a peach for hours.
Do you want lunch?
You're A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
I can't talk too long. I gotta poo.
Oh, no, not the peach! Not the peach! Ah!
It's like looking at a mirror.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of Effin Birds Presents Travolta Cage, a podcast about the two greatest actors in cinema history. I'm Clint Worthington. I'm a senior writer for Consequence of Sound and editor-in-chief of the film and TV website, The Spool.
My name is Nathan Rabin, and I am the proprietor and writer and editor and everything for Nathan Rabin's Happy Place and the co-host of this podcast that you are listening to now.
And this episode, we are joined by a very special guest, film critic extraordinaire, Craig D. Lindsay. Hey, Craig, how's it going?
Hey, what's up?
Why don't you tell the people what you do and where they can find your stuff?
Well, I'm down here in Houston, Texas, so you can mostly find my stuff on Houston Chronicle, you know, at the Houston Chronicle, like HoustonChronicle.com or Culture Map. Houston. I write occasionally for Nashville Scene when they let me. Just starting to do stuff for Crooked Marquee over there. I have a podcast which I need to start doing again, called Everything Is Canceled, which you can look on all the, you know, the Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all that stuff. Basically just type in at Uncle Crizzle. And, you know, it'll take you to wherever they have Twitter, you know, and the Instagram, and then I'm on TikTok. I'm not posting any shit, but I'm on TikTok at Uncle Crizzle, UNLCLECRIZZLE. that's how old I'm getting, because like my birthday's coming up soon. It's like, is that spelled correctly?
Yeah, well, happy upcoming birthday, and we're sorry that your gift is watching two terrible movies from John Travolta and Nicolas Cage. For those of you who are just joining us for your first episode and decided on this one for whatever reason, the premise of the podcast is we're going through chronologically the filmographies of one Sir John Travolta and one Sir Nicolas Cage, who we think are two of the most intriguing, in both good and sometimes bad ways, actors in cinema history. And this week we're at the stage in the podcast where the early days of their stardom have faded, and they're sort of waiting for their comebacks, right? So we are now going to, this is probably maybe one of the first in what will surely be a long series of episodes where we're going to talk about really, really bad movies that they've done that they would probably just as soon rather forget. On Travolta's end, there is the 1991/1994 movie Eyes of an Angel. And then there is the Nick Cage, Sam Jackson, sort of racially charged buddy comedy, Amos and Andrew.
Andrew Sterling has always dreamed of leaving the big city and escaping to a secluded island. No stress, no hassles, no problems. That is, until he met another man trying to escape.
You're in here.
Andrew meets Amos.
I have a shotgun. You have a frying pan.
And in one wild night...
I want $1 million! And a helicopter!
Put your weapon down. Let your hostage go.
Two guys from two different worlds.
Maybe you've heard of the Pulitzer Prize.
You won that?
I did.
How much you win?
In one fell swoop... became partners in crime.
We're gangsters.
Freeze!
We're outlaws.
Sounded like they were getting pretty chummy to me.
Two people who came to an island for one reason.
Get it!
To escape.
Sit!
Not you.
Nicolas Cage.
Contributing to the delinquency of a minor.
What do you have to say about that? She looked 18.
Samuel L. Jackson. Amos and Andrew, a comedy about two mismatched men trying to escape from each other.
Yep, we have kind of reached the dregs. And yeah, this is kind of an interesting period in Nicolas Cage's career. Because yeah, the last film that we saw was Honeymoon in Vegas, which is kind of him transitioning into sort of a more mainstream, more commercial kind of thing with, you know, sort of his integrity and his talent intact. And that is not so much the case this time around. I actually wrote about this movie for Vulture or slash Splitsider when I wrote about it. And then it morphed into Vulture. And I remember finding it really, really interesting and having a lot of potential and some really great moments. And watching it again for this, I was like, what the fuck was I smoking? Because this is a very, very bad motion picture. But I feel like this is a particularly weird and loaded movie to watch in this particular cultural moment when I feel like we have a lot of hypersensitivity to issues of race and class, and this movie is hyper insensitive and kind of very careless in the way that it depicts some pretty heavy subject matter. Do you want to talk a little bit about the premise of Amos and Andrew's there, Clint?
Yes, but before I do, I will mention that we do have a Patreon, patreon.com/TravoltaCage. If you want to help us keep the lights on, please throw us a buck or two there. But yeah, on to Amos and Andrew. Yeah, this is it's been very interesting moment for me, especially because recently, in addition to this and other assignments, I've been looking a lot at like sort of racially charged movies of the early 90s. And there is this strange parallel where it's like this post LA riots kind of reckoning with, you know, with racial injustice and racial inequality and police brutality. And this moment now where we're also, you know, like you said, hypersensitive to it. And it feels so weird to watch Amos and Andrew now, where you can see them sort of like, it's very like well-meaning white screenwriter, right, white director. It's Emax Fry who wrote the screenplay for Something Wild, and I think recently won an Oscar for co-writing the screenplay to Foxcatcher. Oh yeah, that's right.
I don't think they won necessarily. I think they were nominated.
Oh, they were nominated. Well,
that's right. I do not believe.
Tried to give them too much credit. But Amos and Andrew, you know, follows the story of Sam Jackson's character, Andrew Sterling, who is this well-off black intellectual, somewhat along the lines of like a Cornel West or something like that, where he's wealthy enough to buy this nice home on this island and of this well-meaning, this lily white community of like pretty wealthy white liberals of kind of the Bradley Whitford and Get Out mold. And, you know, essentially the first night he's there on this New England resort, two of his neighbors see him installing his stereo. And as they explain later to the police in a rather incriminating MacGuffin interview tape, when they see, you know, a black man in a rich, you know, affluent and neighborhood with a stereo, you just know they're looking for trouble. And so that the dominoes fall, the police get involved, and this entire sort of semi hostage situation happens where the police open fire on him before realizing that, well, first of all, they're not really mad that, you know, they're not really embarrassed that they shot a black man. They're embarrassed that they shot at a wealthy black man who can garner a lot of publicity. So that, you know, it'll hurt the sheriff's reelection campaign. So they stage this thing where Nick Cage's Amos, who is a down on his luck, down and out, dirty criminal, they work out a deal where he sneaks into Andrew's home, pretends to take him hostage so he can take the fall for it, which ends up dovetailing into this strange, awkward, tone-deaf buddy comedy thing that takes a few stabs at racial inequality but doesn't really land.
Yeah, totally. And again, there are just so many elements of this movie that have so much potential and can do so much that just kind of go nowhere. One of which is the neighbors who find Samuel L. Jackson breaking into his own house. One of them is played by Michael Lerner from Barton Fink, a really, really funny, really talented, very distinctive character actor. And again, he is very much kind of an old school liberal. He's continually mentioning that he was used to represent the Chicago Seven. And again, there are just these moments where kind of late in the film, they're been taken hostage. And Samuel Jackson is kind of explaining the situation, and Michael Lerner says, if that's true, then you have a great case. You can sue them for a lot of money. And he's the person who put him in this case, you know? So there again, there's this kind of idea of you know, these stabs at the hypocrisy and the shallowness and the racism and the greed and the self-interest of white liberals that, again, I felt like could be a lot sharper than it actually was. This is also a film that's just incredibly careless. I mean, Jesus, fucking 20 minutes in, Brad Dourif, who's part of just an absolutely important cast.
Brad Dourif as Donaldson, by the way, which one of my favorite things in opening credits is letting us know the name of the character an actor is going to play as if that means anything to us.
Yeah. Well, we'll be writing that, jotting that down in our notebook. How excited we are to see
Donaldson. Gotcha.
Yeah, and again, he just kind of, he puts black on his face for night mode. And again, you just, I just groaned internally, externally. Later on, they put a black dirt all over Nicolas Cage's face. And it's just like, blackface is something that if you're going to do it at all, needs to be handled with extraordinary sensitivity and care and caution. And they just don't have a fucking iota of that in this ridiculous motion picture. And there's just this kind of sense of dread as something that starts off really promising just gets less and less salvageable by the scene.
Right. Craig, we haven't heard from you yet. What do you think of Amos and Andrew?
Well, first, it should be established that I'm African-American, which I'm sure had nothing to do with your decision to have me on the show to talk about this movie. But it's just, I gotta take the contrarian Armand White stance.
Okay.
And say, you know, here's because I have I actually have history with this movie because I saw it when it came out on video. The movie came out in '93, and then it came out like a few months later, and then I saw it. And keep in mind, I read all the reviews when that came out back then, where it's just like, you know, Owen Gleiberman gave it an F. And, you know, just like, you know, all these white critics said all these things about this movie. So I'm watching it, think it's going to be complete garbage. And then I'm watching it and I got, you know, it's over the top as hell, but, you know, I kind of like it. I'm just trying, I was trying to figure out why did all those critics say, you know, say this was a bad movie, this was the worst movie of the year. And it wasn't until years and years later when I finally realized, oh, this movie makes white people look like fucking idiots.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Oh, it 100% does, yeah.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's even funny watching it now because it's just like, it's still an over-the-top, you know, kind of quasi-satire, but when you juxtaposition, you know, with all the stuff that's been happening now, I mean, literally, you know, when you look at the movie now, just like this movie kind of foresaw the whole Karen Kevin boom that's been happening right now.
The lawyers are like, we literally have them in the news right now. Like those St. Louis lawyers who were out pointing the guns everywhere. Like as soon as I saw them, like, oh, that's the McCloskeys.
Yeah, and also like, I don't know if you've been following, you know, all the various Instagram pages now devoted to Karens and everything, how they basically just calling up, you know, black people for doing whatever. You know, not even just black people, just people of color. Just like, I don't want them on my lawn. What are you doing in this neighborhood? And I mean, right. I think, like, you know, funny, even in back then when there wasn't, when they weren't cameras on cell phones, nobody could capture the sheer unadulterated racism that is happening now. So, like, back then, probably when Amos and Andrew came out, everything looked so implausible. But watch it now, just like, oh, this happened last week.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing. Like, I'm with you. Like, the first 30 minutes really did, like, have me. I was like, oh, man, this does feel like it's sort of happening, you know, now. And there is, you know, I do think the movie's heart is very much in the right place. I just think, like, for me, it was an issue of just, like, the movie around it not being very funny. And I didn't think that, like, they got, I don't know, I didn't think they got the best from, like, the leads, for instance. But, like,
Well, one thing that kind of struck me was, because again, yeah, there are all sorts of elements of this movie that are very, very timely and very, very resonant. One of which is, again, this kind of had a bit of the Ace in the Hole. This kind of had a bit of the Billy Wilder's wonderful, wonderful sort of media satire.
Yeah.
Very dark, very brilliant, very incisive. And I felt like this was kind of a sitcom version of that. And one of the ways in which this resembles Ace in the Hole is that a media circus very quickly develops over this situation, this racially charged situation. And one of the people who kind of flock to it is a very flamboyant preacher, kind of in the Al Sharpton mold, played by Giancarlo Esposito as Reverend Fenton Broome. And he's like, you know, this brother has been, you know, maligned, he's being oppressed. And they treat him like he's a race huckster, they treat him like he's a bit of a buffoon, that he's kind of exploiting and manipulating this situation to his own advantage. He's 100% right. Like, he is exactly right. Like, he is, like, Samuel Jackson's character is a victim of horrible racism. It's because of who he is. It's institutional. It's personal. It's the police. It's well-meaning liberals. Like, he is 100% in the right, and yet they act as if he's just kind of making this big show for the sake of making a big show. There's also, again, this, you know, sort of very, very timely moment where they're carrying torches as they confront this brutality, and one of them accidentally sort of falls into the house and accidentally starts a riot. And then Giancarlo Esposito is like, whoop, this is my time to go. And again, there was a bit of a sense of, you know, everybody on this side is crazy and weird and just out for themselves. And it's like, no. You know, the racist cops, the racist, like, they're the people who are being, and again, Nicolas Cage's character, I feel like, is very casually racist in a way that the movie doesn't really hold him accountable for. They're just kind of, his heart is good, so if he's kind of a dick and he kind of treats Samuel Jackson in fairly racist ways, that's okay, because ultimately he's...
Yeah, it's funny when you talk about, especially the Giancarlo Esposito character, just like kind of has not only shades of, you know, Al Sharpton, especially, you know, what happened in the late 80s, but I forget the name of the character that Tom Wolfe created in the Bonfire of the Vanities, that was right, kind of modeled right on Al Sharpton. So just like this idea of the preacher just making a big show out of everything. Mm-hmm. And I was just watching it, I just kind of just immediately got, it could have, let me tell you this, it could have gotten a lot more racist.
Oh, yeah,
yeah, sure.
I think the fact that it was just racist enough to get the point across.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
we should give them points for that. Yeah. I will give the movie points for understanding, even in 1991, that all cops are bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and we haven't talked at all, too. Again, I feel like this definitely is a satire, but it's such a clumsy, such a heavy-handed satire. One of the ways in which it is incredibly clumsy is the bad guy is played by Dabney Coleman. And I like Dabney Coleman. He can be great, but when he's just playing a sleazebag, he can be very, very forgettable, very kind of perfunctory. And I felt like this was very much sort of the stock Dabney Coleman sleazebag character. There's a shot where I think they do like a crane up, and oh my goodness, there's a billboard, and he's running for political office. And again, I feel like that's just a very sort of cheap way of saying this is a political satire.
There is that recurring gag where someone says in an election year, and then the score comes up. It's like, boom, 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 boom. Like, it's one of those things where, like, you know, I don't take as much, you know, umbrage with the handling of the satire as I do the handling of the jokes. I just kind of wish I kind of wish it either was funnier or it tried less to be funny.
Yeah. Because it's definitely going for laughs as well as satire, and it doesn't really hit on either level, for me at least.
Yeah, it's funny. I thought, you know, you guys have a lot to say about the movie. We got the same thing yet about Nicolas Cage's character's predilection for 17-year-old white girls.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
That's another element of this movie that has aged very, very poorly and that they seem to think is either charming or not a big deal.
Yeah, that's a humanizing moment supposed to be for Amos.
Yeah, the fact that Brad Dourif is not sympathetic in this movie. He's singularly non-sympathetic in this movie. The fact that Nicolas Cage's character is sympathetic at all, I think, is a testament to Nicolas Cage as an actor. Because as written, he's just a fucking scumbag. You know, he's into underage girls. He's kind of racist. He's willing to do gross, grubby things out of self-interest. He says a lot of kind of shitty things to Samuel Jackson. But you end up kind of liking him in spite of himself. And I think that's kind of exclusively because of Nicolas Cage. I think we're also kind of getting to the age where I feel like Nicolas Cage hit the 30s hard. I know, he's 20.
He looks real sleepy.
Oh, well, he was very handsome and cut and beautiful, and then I think he turned, like, 31, and, like, sort of his eyes got cloudy, and his hair started to recede. His muscles kind of went down on each other, and you kind of have, yeah, the sort of scummy mid-period Nicolas Cage here that, again, I wish that they, like, the pairing of Samuel L. Jackson and Nicolas Cage is so inspired and has so much potential.
And it wouldn't be the last time, right, because he did Kiss of Death.
I liked Samuel L. Jackson's performance here. I wish that they had a better sense of who he was. So you mentioned this before, there's this, you know, he says to him, like, I don't know, but I think you're the, you know, whitest black person I've ever met. And then there's a moment later on where Samuel L. Jackson says, you know, you weren't wrong about the things that you said about me. And it's like, what do you mean? Why are you giving this character credit? You know, why are you treating his casual racism like it's some sort of like unvarnished truth telling?
Yeah. It's a little hard to handle sometimes. But I mean, the thing that that resonated with me was that the sentence he says afterwards, where it's like, you know, like whatever you may think about me, of course, like I should be able to put up my stereo in my own home without being assumed to be a thief.
Yeah. Well, you gotta understand, like for that kind of, for Samuel Jackson's character, he, you know, it's kind of like that thing where, because let's face it, he's basically playing Henry Louis Gates in some aspect, but it's just like, you know, and just, you know, like a Henry Louis Gates, Cornel West type of character, and he's a like a African American scholar, and even Nicolas Cage's character is like. Yeah, you know, you're not the, you know, the stereotypical black person and everything. I mean, you may even have a white wife and everything. So it's just like for, yeah, and as someone can speak from experience who, you know, just put, yeah, you can even hear now from this voice that you probably would have thought, oh, that dude, you know, is black and knows black stuff. But it's just like for his character, you know, he does like straddle that line where he's black and knows that he's black, but at the same time, you know, he doesn't give off the stereotypical black vibe, even though. Right. But that's like the idea. The whole point of the movie is that even though he is this person who has amassed this type of like a reputation for, because they can't, in the movie they kind of. He's referred to as the Andrew Sterling and everything. It's just like, but they, you know, but white people just see him in his own home moving a stereo and they automatically think, oh, who's that nigga in the house right there? So it's just.
Right.
So it just brings that stuff up.
Right. And the stuff with the wife, the open question about like whether his wife is white or black was also weird to me, especially when they reveal at the end that he does indeed have a black wife and Amos gives her that like strangely approving nod.
Yeah.
Which I found strange, but yeah.
Was there, what in this movie did you guys like? For me, and again, kind of the scene that the most is one that has absolutely nothing to do with moving the plot forward. forward. It's a scene where Nicolas Cage finds some weed, and his pocket is like some buried treasure, man. And then he tells Samuel L. Jackson this long, meandering, kind of pointless story about getting sea monkeys when he was sort of a sad latchkey kid, and how excited he was, and how he looked forward to it, and how, you know, they were kind of this idealist family, and he wished that he could be part of a family of the sea monkeys, and it doesn't go anywhere. But it's just this lovely little standalone moment that sort of tells you so much about this character and who he is. And I think it's maybe one of the only times in the movie where he's like vulnerable and very lovable, and you kind of see him as a human being as opposed to part of this sort of misfiring farcical plot that kind of consumes the entire film. What did you guys like about this movie, if you know, specifically?
Well, I mean, I think there are elements to, obviously, I think the satire is I think pointed for the time, especially. Like, I mean, I think there is something valuable about a movie that comes out so shortly after the LA riots that at least tries to handle the idea of even, like, you know, the underlying racism of well-meaning liberals, and recognizing the deep flaws in the police force where there's like absolute corruption and they're willing to cover their ass because they want to maintain their power. And that kind of stuff is really, really cool. I was just less of a fan of things, of just gags like pointing out the irony of their two names, which is like, I think is just inherent in the premise, but I feel like they, I don't know, maybe they tipped that hand a little bit too hard. They could have tipped it harder, I guess, because at least they don't go into a whole discussion about like why Amos and Andrew is a play on Amos and Andy and why that's racist. But, you know, even just the fact that they had to point it out felt like that was the kind of school of humor they were going for. And it was just like, okay, well, I mean, I get it. Where is the gag, I suppose?
Yeah, it also makes me wonder if there was a much smarter, much darker version of this motion picture. And then got down by the studio.
I'm generally a fan of the first act. Like, the first act is really, really incisive and I think really, really good. And I think once they try to get bogged down in Amos and Andrew's actual dynamic, then it starts to fall apart a little bit for me.
And I also do, like, I like the scenes where the kind of establishing sort of Samuel L. Jackson is kind of this sort of prickly, you know, kind of exacting, like, this, you know, very continental figure. And I feel like at a certain point, they sort of see him exclusively through the prism of race. And I think that's kind of, you know, comes as a territory when making a comedy like this. But it seems like a waste because, you know, there's so much more to him. And when you, at a certain point, it just seems like, sort of the humanity is sort of, it loses sight of, you know?
The more I think about the movie and more, the more I watch it, like, you know, it feels weird to, like, in 2020, look at a shot like Dabney Coleman looking down the lens of a camera and saying, fuck the First Amendment, and saying, oh, well, that's unrealistic. I'm like, it's not anymore, you know? I don't know. It's just kind of wild to think about.
Yeah.
I just like seeing white people look like fucking idiots.
Yeah.
And just basically this movie gives me that. It's like, when I realize it, even like in thinking about, like I said, all the critics who slammed it, even talking about now, I hope you understand what it feels like when you watch a movie full of like black people acting like idiots, and why we're pissed off about it. Like, you know,
absolutely.
Like seeing like some other, you know, just like some movie where I guess like they're just all the stereotypical black shit, like gang banging and pimps and hoes, or just like all those, you know, those Wayans Brothers comedy where they acted like fucking idiots. And so we're just like, what? Like, shit, why they have to do the at least those movies, you know, making us look stupid all the time. And it's just like when this came out, is, you know, I just like, you know, it took me a while, but I got it.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it makes y'all look stupid and racist, and it's just like, but it's sadly, but, you know, sadly, it's so prevalent right now. It's just like, Mm-hmm. I'm pretty, like, people don't even know much about this movie, but I'm pretty sure if people saw it now, they're just like, how did they know way back then that this was almost going to be the norm? Just you know, just upscale Tony white people just calling the cops on black dudes because they saw them doing suspicious shit in a home that's theirs. I mean, I can point you to several videos of like right now of white people just like complaining, like, what are you doing here? What are you doing? And they'll be outside their own home. It is just like that's kind of like when you see, you know, it's funny because even when all those videos started happening, I immediately started thinking of this movie and what was going on. And I mean, listen, it's and, you know, listen, the second part of it kind of lags, and there, like you said, there are jokes that don't necessarily land, but just like overall, I think it tells like the just basically the shit black people go through on the regular, and just whether you are a successful African American, you still have to answer to people, you know, it's, you know, whether it's like the rich white couple, or even somebody like Nicolas Cage's character, like who you are and who you represent. It's just like, are you a black person? Like, that's the thing that's not discussed a lot, is just African Americans having to explain their blackness to even each other. It's just like, because how black are you? Because it's almost it's like a common thing people have to know. Just like, are you, like, you hear that shit, like, you know, he's black. He's not black. He's black. I've had people tell me that, I've had white people tell me that I am the whitest black person they know. And at the same time, they're still fucking scared of me. Just like when I do some shit and they just get uncomfortable about it. It's just like, so it's just, you know, this movie, I understand you guys not really like for what it is, or just, you know, from a standpoint, but for somebody like me, it's like takes on a whole different, like, I get a whole different perspective off it, which is just like, it kind of, you know, it may not completely be, I mean, maybe if, like, you know, if Emax Fry actually, I don't know if he did talk to black people while writing the script or direct making a movie or anything like that, but maybe like have more consultation, trying to, you know, get like you know, when Mel Brooks hired Richard Pryor to be on the writing team for Blazing Saddles, like, just to get, hey, we may need a black person's perspective on all this. But yeah, it's just like, just but for being what it is, for like kind of like just an interesting, you know, film to see at that time, and actually spoke to me in ways that might not speak to white people who kind of just sees just white people acting stupid.
No, for sure. And I completely respect that. And I mean, again, like, I do think it's more interesting than, like, I don't know, than I was going to give it credit for when I first started watching it, especially that first act, I think is super cool. But yeah, and I do think it's aged very, very interestingly now, in an age where things like police brutality, things like, you know, white people calling the cops on black people for, like, no good reason, is more in the public eye than ever in the age of cell phones, where there's, like, you know, unless you're completely delusional, you can't explain away the footage that you see.
Yeah,
that kind of stuff.
And so, people, I mean, choose to be delusional anyway. So just like, I'm just gonna ignore everything and just hope it goes away.
Yeah, exactly. Like, there's that sort of just world fallacy where, like, you know, something had to have justified it. And I'm like, no, there's no way. You look at this and there's no way to justify it. But yeah.
Well, I think there's also this idea that if you are successful, you know, as Colin Kaepernick, these various other folks are, then you have absolutely no right to complain because, my God, you're one of capitalism's winners and everything's great for you and you can afford a fancy house. So why on earth would you complain about racism? And this illustrates that because it does not matter how rich you are, it doesn't matter how successful you are, it doesn't matter if you win a Pulitzer
Prize. Yeah, because you can't escape it.
You're going to be seen as a black man first and everything else second. And there are all these moments that are, again, kind of casually very truthful. One of which was, you know, you have this montage of the different reporters talking about the scene, and they describe Andrew Sterling as a black writer, you know, and that's Spike Lee, black filmmaker, you know, and you would never do that with a white person. It would never be white filmmaker Steven Spielberg, white writer John Grisham. But again, if you are black in America in 1993 or today, that is how society is going to see you first and foremost, and it will have a hard time getting beyond that. I sort of talk about it being very truthful. One of the other windows that's open on my computer now, the headline is Trump is intervening in the case of the couple who pointed guns at protesters outside their mansion.
Right.
Missouri governor. So again, these fucking morons who use their guns for the first, and again, you look at like their history, nothing but horrible things. Anti-Semitism, racism.
Homophobia, yeah.
Like, they're horrible, horrible human beings. And the president of the United States is like, ooh, those horrible white people pointing guns at black people. I will swoop in and make sure that they're freed from any kind of... Like, that is just so disgusting. And yeah, again, I just kind of... I'm getting angrier and angrier. And again, I feel like this is a movie that has elements of truth and elements of bullshit. Right. And yeah, kind of both times that I've seen it. Sort of different parts of it kind of registered more strongly. But yeah, it definitely is an interesting movie. And it's nice to see a movie explore race and deal with race, even if it does so in kind of a clumsy, kind of clunky sort of way.
Yeah, I think at the end of go ahead.
Well, okay, I just say, like, yes, I mean, kind of in hearing you guys talk about it, just like you just feel like this is all, you know, silly because you don't, you know, it just makes you look embarrassed. It makes you feel embarrassed so much. Just like, gosh, yeah, just this is a movie about white people being stupid, and it's just like you don't. It just like it's kind of like watching your parents dance. that image where it's just like you know you're a part of it, but at the same time you don't. You want to distance yourself from it, and you don't want it. You don't want that image portrayed because it does make not make you look bad but make you feel bad knowing that there are people out there who would so like obviously do that stuff and especially now just so it's just like you know it's understandable how you guys would feel that way about this film just from a personal level because just like from everything that's out there. And just, I'm just, you know, it was just from what you guys are saying, it just pisses you off.
I want to say I agree with you. I think the white people are very deeply, deeply, deeply embarrassing. And certainly my problems with this were sort of more rooted in comedy and storytelling and less in being proud of being white and embarrassed that white people were being portrayed as buffoons, which they are in this movie and deserve at least so.
That said, I still don't think the movie should have ended with giving Nick Cage the pass to be called brother. I don't think he'd earned that yet, but you know.
Well, at least, you know, he did have that gold tooth in his mouth, so just like.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah,
Right. Well, do we have any thoughts on Amos and Andrew? I think I'm in general agreement that I think the social satire stuff works a lot better than just like the mechanics of the comedy, but like. But I do think that it's aged very interestingly in the 20 years since it was released.
Oh, definitely. I think kind of Samuel L. Jackson wasn't really Samuel L. Jackson, kind of the icon that he would become at this point. I think, you know, sort of considering the premise of this website. What the fuck am I talking about? The premise of this podcast, it will be, you know, sort of Pulp Fiction. You know, a leader that would kind of... make him, you know, the god of cinema that he would become today. And I also thought it was kind of interesting, the terrible, terrible 1990s fashions. something we're about to experience a whole lot of very unflattering jeans, a bunch of pullovers. It's about to get real ugly. And I lived through that horrible, horrible sartorial period. So I know how just how grim it's about to get.
It's a big film for sweaters.
Yeah. and also, you know, we're talking about, talking about this, just how much of the age, this takes you back to a time when apparently statutory rape was very funny.
Yeah. Right? Oh, boy.
Yeah, because I remember they used in the trailer that line where he said, well, she looked 18. Okay. All right.
Well. Yeah, I think that it's a good thing that we are not quite so cavalier about statutory rape or blackface. In 2020, that if you're going to deal with either, you better think long and hard and be careful and cautious in how you do it. Yeah. So you're not just blatantly offensive for no good damn reason at all.
Right. All right, well, let's talk about a movie that is that is way more disposable, I think. Eyes of an Angel, a movie so disposable that they released it under one title in, like, U.S. and Europe in 91, and then they trotted it back out around 94 when Pulp Fiction came out under its original title, Eyes of an Angel.
This could be a story about loss, but it's about hope. It could be about crime, but it's about change.
Such a loser, Bubby. I got my good points.
It could be about a stranger, but it's about a family.
We're going to take a trip. Can you pack a bag?
Thought I told you to get rid of the dog.
You wouldn't leave.
Get in.
Now, Trans World Entertainment presents John Travolta in a role you will always remember, in a film you will never forget.
I'm going to call Georgie, and I'm going to have you stay there for a while, okay?
You don't want me to be with you?
You seen my kid? She's gone.
They were just looking for a chance. But what they found was a miracle. John Travolta, Ellie Rabb, Eyes of an Angel.
Now, Craig, do you want to describe the story of Eyes of an Angel?
Well, first off, has nothing to do with Eyes or an Angel.
Right.
It's a lovely story about a girl, a dog, and John Travolta saying asshole for about 90 minutes.
Yeah, pretty much.
It's just a story about a girl who befriends a former underground fight dog. And who gets thrown off of a bridge, which, yeah, that was an interesting scene to watch.
Right.
And then he nurses the dog to health with lots of spam. and she has a father, deadbeat dad, played by John Travolta, who is just a straight up asshole.
He's the worst.
And just like he just goes through a lot of shit, and just like they have to move from Chicago to Los Angeles, and during the trip she leaves clothing all through the trip so the dog could follow her all the way through the same desert road to LA, and they all get together to basically prove their family and prove to the lead singer of Tito and Tarantula that it's a fucking movie from the 90s, and Michael Douglas produced it, and we both all saw it in chopped up versions on YouTube, like it's 2008.
Yes.
So that's what we did.
That's one of the interesting things about this project is just the sheer amount of work that sometimes goes into finding movies that are just not available. And Eyes of an Angel is the case. You cannot stream it anywhere. I think like next week we're going to talk about Red Rock West, which like you have to go down some really shady avenues to find that because like
and this is interesting.
It's like $100 on Amazon.
It's on Peacock.
It's not on Peacock. It's not on Amazon Prime. And there are TV movies where Cloris Leachman gives everybody VD on Amazon Prime. All right, it's like nowhere. And I'm pretty sure I understand why, because it's like it's a movie that begins like first 9 minutes is just dog brutality. So and then nobody wants to see that.
Right.
And by the way, like when we all saw it on YouTube, you could tell it was a VHS rip because pan and scan like a motherfucker. It's just like, I forgot how barbaric watching movies were on VHS back in the day when I saw this movie.
Those truly were the dark ages. Yeah, there's nothing quite like seeing fuzzy dog violence.
Yeah. You sort of talked about a sort of movies hitting home for you, and this was a weird movie for me to watch because I feel like, I don't know if you guys are like this, but I enjoy movies inherently more if they're set in cities that I've lived in. If I'm like, oh, like, this is my dumb experience of this movie, the bridge where they throw him off of. I'm like, I've been to that bridge. Is that Clark? Is that Wabash? Which train stop to let off here? And the crazy thing about this is it's set in Chicago, and you know, the little girl is 11, 12 years old, and I was that little girl. When I was a boy, when I was in my teens, when I was in my tweens, I was a latchkey kid, and I had a single father, and he was broke, and he was depressed, and the world just kicked him around. And I kind of had to learn to grow up very fast. I kind of had to, you know, I know what it's like to, you know, be like, oh, dad's out. I got to figure out what I'm going to do tonight. I'll just hang out in, you know, restaurants and grocery stores and whatnot. And I can say with 100% authority that this movie is total bullshit. That having lived this experience, like, it was nothing whatsoever like that. And this is one of those, like, perversely miserable movies that just takes glee in shitting in the mouths of its protagonists, of just treating them so unbelievably terribly for no fucking reason except for drama, except for conflict, except that... You know, for something to be happening. And yeah, John Travolta's character, Bobby, who literally spends his whole movie smoking and suffering. Those are like the two things that he does. His wife died of a drug overdose. And then he got sober. And you would imagine, so for the sake of like his, you know, 11, 12 year old sad-eyed daughter, and you would imagine that people would think that was a good thing and be kind to him and be nice. But instead, everybody just treats him like total fucking shit. He goes to his ex-brother-in-law, who, as you said, played by Tito of Tito and the Tarantulas, who's also in True Stories, a pretty interesting dude who is very, very bad here. And he's like, hey, you're a loser and you can't hold down a job. You can't keep your wife from dying a horrible death. So he gives him a job as a courier.
Well, no. The Tito and Tarantula, that's Sissy. That's the guy who runs the dog fighting stuff.
Right.
The brother-in-law is Jeffrey DeMunn, Frank Darabont, stalwart.
Tito's brother-in-law.
I forgot that they're both weirdly related.
Yeah. So there's a scene, and literally where he just says like, "Oh, he had a really good first day. He did everything right. He even turned on a drink." Mm-hmm. So Tito of Tito and the Tarantula says, "Well, why don't you guys fuck with him for no fucking reason whatsoever?"
Right.
They just say like, let's just make his life horrible for no reason whatsoever. So they're like, hey, you came up $100 short. You know, that's bad news. And they're about to beat the living shit out of him for no reason at all. And then he turns the tables and he steals their car and he steals their money. And then everywhere they go from there, they're just fucking terrible. And this movie reminded me, the dog plot reminded me a lot of the movie Jaws, The Revenge. Clint, I think we might have actually talked about Jaws.
I think we did, yeah, on the previous iteration of this podcast.
And it's legendary for its wonderful, wonderful plot in which the family of the shark from Jaws decides to get revenge on the family of the Brodies. So the shark literally travels from New England all the way down to the Bahamas so that it can act revenge. And at one point in the novelization, they explain that this was accomplished through voodoo, that the Brody family had like run afoul of witch doctors. So they sent a killer shark from New England all the way to the Bahamas. The thing that's crazy about Eyes of an Angel, beyond everything else, is that it's supposed to be based on a true story.
Right. I think the true story is just that dogfighting exists.
Exactly. And I love just how fucking melodramatic it is. But like during the dogfighting scene, there's like really heavy music. They're like, this is bad. We want to let you know that we, the makers of the Eyes of Angels, think that dogfighting is bad and we're against it. We think it's very grubby. And this dog is the most miraculous dog in the history of the world. Like, it would make more sense that this dog was created in a laboratory by the Pentagon's top scientists. Then it does. This is an actual dog that lives in the real world and has, I mean, I wouldn't be able to track down somebody halfway across the entire country. And I'm a human being. I'm substantially smarter than a dog.
Plus that dog is a great actor.
Like, better actor than a lot of the cast.
Like they literally hired like the Willem Dafoe of dog actors. And just where do they find this dog Tripoli and just everything?
Right. And you have to, it's hard to act when your character doesn't have a name. It's just as the dog.
The dog doesn't have a name and the girl doesn't have a name.
Right.
Oh, and the goons don't have a name either. And did you guys see, I love that Richard Edson plays one of the goons, and I really hope he did not have to audition for that role. I'm Richard Edson. Cast me in this fucking movie. I literally could play this role in my sleep. I suspect that he did. There's just moments that were horrifying to me. Personally, there's a moment deep into the film where John Travolta and his daughter, you know, their car had just been stolen. These are the kind of things that happened to him over the course of this movie. And he's like, "Oh, I'll get you a hot dog." Oh. So he
doesn't say that. He said, "Let me go get you a goddamn hot dog or something.
Get you a goddamn hot dog." And he slathers ketchup all over the hot dog, and I'm just like, "You're from Chicago. You're a Chicagoan." Yeah, it's physically painful for me to see this disgust, like this beautiful hot dog
being desecrated in that way.
All of these horrible, horrible. And again, these are just, you know, not the biggest thing in the world, but I feel like they get everything wrong. And again, we sort of talk about, you know, why Pulp Fiction was big. This is barely a fucking movie. Like, this is grubby. Like, it's hard to believe. Like, you were in fucking Grease, dude. You were in Blowout. You were in, like, some of the best movies of the 1970s. And now you're doing this direct-to-video crap. And this had to be so cheap, too. Like, Michael Douglas produced this. Like, what the hell was he thinking? Yeah. You did Once Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and you did this one as well. It really is. I would love to write John Travolta's memoirs and ask him, what the fuck were you thinking about a lot of the movies that he made? But I think this and Chains of Gold kind of stuck out in my mind, in part because they're both casually racist, where he plays this, you know, sort of caretaker of this impossibly beautiful white child that he has to protect from this cartoonishly evil Hispanic person who's involved in the world of dog fighting. And again, like, yeah, the dog fighting thing just did not need to exist in this movie.
And also, if you had Nathan, like, when he gave the girl the hot dog, like, she just forgot how to eat it.
Yeah. I forgot how she eats it.
In her face, and I'm like, what the hell is going on? Both of you are from Chicago. You have no idea just how hot dog etiquette works anymore. Right. It's just like,
in order to get your citizenship card for Chicago, you have to go through a course in how to eat a Chicago hot dog. Just like, you did not do the training. It's just monotonous and, like you said, really grubby and melodramatic, and it's just kind of sheer unremitting misery porn. It was just a slog to get through.
Well, can I just say, like, before I get, I just gotta say, you know, for a person, for like, you know, John Travolta's character is broke, doesn't seem to have a job, you know, he's just barely hang through. But that apartment that they're in, maybe it's just me, but wasn't that like very nice, you know, nice as hell for two broke people?
Like, I, as somebody who was that child when I was 12 years old, I was like, I lived in shittier apartments than this. It's like, yeah, it's not great that it's right next to an L stop, you know, and there's a railroad apartment. But like, that's pretty fucking nice. Like, you're doing,
yeah.
Instagram, like, there are some actors who are just so handsome and so charismatic that it's hard to buy them as losers with nothing whatsoever going on in their lives. And John Travolta is one of those where it's like, you can't find like a woman to like let your kids sleep on the couch for a couple of weeks. Like, you can charm the fuck out of a lot of people. And he goes to California. He's like, oh, I gotta see my brother. He's, you know, the only person who likes me. And then he goes to California and he's like, yeah, I always disliked you. You always were an asshole. You couldn't keep your wife from dying of a heroin overdose. He's like, oh, I dislike you too. And I felt like if this was like a 1976 character study, you know, like, he would be this fascinating character. He would be dark and troubled, but, you know, sympathetic and vulnerable. But this is a 1991 movie, and he's just an asshole in addition to being a loser.
Right.
His character is just so poorly written. I mean, there's no emotional through line. I mean, when we first see him, he's up at the, you know, Tito's sissy's house, just like barely holding through, trying to beg and everything. And then he sees him again in the house. Like, what are you doing here? And it's just like everything just goes back and forth, and then like treats his daughter like, you know, like shit and everything. And he's just like this guy who just constantly has a chip on his shoulder, got an attitude. So you can't, you know, he and like I say, just screams and says asshole all the time. So it's just like, it's like, how should we give a shit about, like, the scenes where it's just like the girl and the dog. Like, I could handle, I enjoyed that, but just like when it's just John Travolta spouting out doing whatever the hell is just like, it was painful as hell to get through this damn movie, even though he was chopped.
Is he a worse parent here or in Look Who's Talking?
Yeah. Thank you so much for here. I think probably the worst thing that he does in here, and this is the climax of this movie, is he's like, you know, he's bottoming out, and I think he falls off the wagon. He's like, oh, things are so terrible. So then he's like, you know, staggering around, and who does he see? The fucking dog. The dog ex machina.
Like a goddamn miracle.
And he's like, oh my goodness, that is so amazing. And then he brings it to the daughter, and then he has the dog fight. Cheeto and the tarantulas, they come back. They're his backup band now. He's got a guitar. It's very confusing. And he's like, you know, oh, you know, I'll let you off the hook if you let your beloved dog engage in one last dog fight. So John Travolta, the hero of this movie, the protagonist, like, oh, that's cool. You know, we can do it. In order to get out, we just gotta, you know, engage in dog fighting one last time. And they do that, and it ends up with the dog, I guess, overriding its conditioning or whatever, and threatening to kill Tito. And he's got his friggin' giant teeth around his neck, and he could fucking murder this person. And he's like, I've chosen not to, because not only am I the smartest dog in history, I'm also a saint. I'm also literally, and again, I kind of felt like this dog should be given custody of the little girl. Because this dog is such a better parent than John Travolta is. This dog is a better human being than John Travolta is. This dog is very impressive. The movie he's in is not.
Can I just say this? When you mentioned the scene where the dog, first of all, the dog finds John Travolta first. Right? You figure like he's been going all around the country smelling the scent of the girl, but for some reason he finds John Travolta first. And John Travolta, he sees the dog and just looks and, I don't know, smiles. He doesn't say, holy shit, that's the dog. What the fuck is he doing here? He doesn't do that. He just, everybody, they just know, like, oh, the dog is here. And you see, he's here with me. So I guess that means he knows where the dog knows where the girl is. And now, because all the girl's lost and shit. And so they all find the dog, and they're all together. They're one happy family. This is a badly written movie.
It's so bad.
It's a horribly written, like the scene you mentioned earlier with John Travolta getting roughed up by the guys. Like, that scene made no sense to me. Like, yeah, just in terms of just
Yeah.
Just saying that. I know it's supposed to set up like the move to LA and everything, but just like, just in terms of like everything else, just like so many things in this movie could have been handled in a more logical, clever way, and they never go that way. And that's why it was so hard for me to go through this movie, because I hate watching movies where like you're watching it and go, nobody in their right mind would do any of that shit. Why are they all doing it? Why do I have to watch it?
This is the most miserable Homeward Bound movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. And it's directed by a guy named Robert Harmon, who's most well known for The Hitcher, but he also, and I found this very interesting, in the mid-90s, directed a TV movie called Gotti.
No, really?
So he's he should have done the Gotti movie. That's all.
Starring Armando Sante, right?
I think so, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
But again, I got to say that as choppy and weird as it was to watch this on YouTube, it also felt very right to not be paying any money to watch this movie, because this is a movie that is worth roughly $0 to experience. Nobody should pay money to see this pile of garbage.
Yeah, and the very interesting thing about watching this on YouTube in chunks is that if you let it autoplay, sometimes it plays them out of order. And so I remember thinking, huh, this movie ended a lot quicker than I thought it was going to. Turned out there was a whole 10-minute stretch in the middle that I had to go back and fill in. It was like a real, yeah. Very wild.
Yeah, I would describe this movie as a real dog.
Ooh, woof. God. God help us. All right. Well, now I think we've...
Oh, and then we've got Look Who's Talking Now ahead of us, which is like another goddamn dog movie.
Yeah. Jiminy, and we didn't even talk about the dogs on Amos and Andrew. There's a whole subplot around the dogs and everything else, but I don't know if we have time for that. But
the dogs are one of the many elements of that horrible movie that does not work at all. I'm getting angry at how terrible it is, and I haven't even rewatched it.
Right. All right, well, I think now that we've mentioned both of these movies, we've talked about them sufficiently, it's time for a very interesting, I think, edition of Cage Match, where we decide which of these two movies is the better movie between Eyes of an Angel and Amos and Andrew. Now, Craig, of these two, which would you prefer people see?
Amos and Andrew, because Eyes of an Angel, a.k.a. the Tender, a.k.a. whatever, can just eat my dick on soft.
I don't know why Eyes of an Angel wasn't Michael's title.
That also
just reminds me of the song from The Heights. You remember that show? It was like Melrose Place, where there was a band.
You mean how do you talk to an angel?
Yeah. How do you but yes, I will say that as flawed as it is, Amos and Andrew is infinitely more interesting and more compelling, and there's so much more going on, maybe too much going on, than Eyes of an Angel, which again is barely a motion picture.
I am inclined to agree with both of you. Amos and Andrew is way more interesting, even with what I feel are some flaws. Like at least it has more to say, or at least it's even the attempt to say something about pertinent issues in America, like is so much better than the weepy dog shit of Eyes of an Angel. So congratulations, Amos and Andrew. You pass on to the next round of whatever form this takes after we actually go through everything. Now, before we conclude this episode of Travolta Cage, there has been some big news on the Travolta front, and that we have lost the late, great Kelly Preston, who was married to Travolta for a very long time and was a big part of his life. And we've talked about her work on this show before. So, Nathan, did you have anything you wanted to say about Kelly Preston?
Yeah, passing? Well, just kind of, since we began this, I'd kind of wondered, like, what is John Travolta up to? Because if you look at Nicolas Cage, he was in 6 movies in 2019, and he's going to be in 6 movies in 2020 as well. And the last sort of new credit Travolta had was for The Fanatic in, I believe, August of last year. And usually Travolta is so prolific and so ubiquitous. So I thought, like, God, what's going on? Is he just living a career slump? And sort of discovered, apparently Kelly Preston had been sort of very privately sort of fighting a war against breast cancer for the last 2 years, which kind of correlates to that. So, and again, I kind of feel like one of the things that makes Travolta compelling as an actor is that there's this kind of fundamental decency to him that I think comes from him as a human being. And sort of warmth, this kind of kindness, and it seemed like he really made his marriage with Kelly Preston work. So yeah, that just is absolutely heartbreaking. I also really, really liked Kelly Preston as an actress. I thought she was, her presence was luminous, you know, like sort of talked in my eulogy that I wrote for my website. You know, it seems kind of redundant to call somebody a beautiful actress because we assume that actresses are going to be beautiful. We assume that they will be charismatic. But she had something special, even in something like The Expert, which is a terrible, terrible, terrible motion picture, but just the she lights up a screen. And the chemistry that she had with Travolta was just explosive. And I know we talked a lot about the dance scene and The Expert, and it's a silly, silly, ridiculous scene. You could easily cut it. It doesn't advance the movie in any way whatsoever, but it illustrates just how magical she could be on screen and just how luminous and how, you know, how explosive her chemistry with Travolta was. And obviously, she's probably best known for Jerry Maguire, where she's very funny and very fearless and very brave. And she was a great, great physical comedian. I think that was another thing that was kind of remarkable about her. So yeah, it's just, it's very, very sad. And it's sad too, because Travolta has had so much tragedy in his life. One of the first movies we talked about was The Boy in the Plastic Bubble. And God, he fell in love with the woman who played his mother in that, Diana Hyland. And she also died of breast cancer, I believe at 41 or 42, even before The Boy in the Plastic Bubble was released. And then his son, Jet Travolta, died of a fatal seizure at 16. So my fucking heart goes out to John Travolta. Like, it's just so sad to have experienced so much tragedy and so much loss, and so much of it dramatic and unexpected. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see where he kind of goes from here, because he's 66 years old and he's a widower, you know, and he's a single man. And yeah, it'll be interesting to see, you know, sort of, yeah, what his next project will be. And yeah, so far the only thing sort of on IMDb is the Kevin Hart Quibi series. I will not be watching because it's on Quibi. But yeah. So I just wanted to say that Kelly Preston, are there any particular, even stuff like, my God, Battlefield Earth. I remember she has this really sexy cameo where she has like this impossibly long tongue. The Cat in the Hat is a terrible, terrible, terrible motion picture. But yeah, there's this, she is just so incredibly gorgeous in it. And my God, if I remember correctly, there's a scene where the Cat in the Hat sees her in her like tight real estate selling uniform and gets a cat boner. Okay. And I'm like, this is so unbelievably gross. But again, there's just, it kind of speaks to, you know, I felt like she was unbelievably sexy, and no matter what she did, even when it was like a kid's movie.
Even when she got the silly shit slapped out of her by Angela Bassett and Wayne Exhale?
Yeah.
So what are you guys, any Kelly Preston moments for y'all?
Yeah. Funny enough, a couple of days ago, I decided to rewatch a movie that that was very much like buried because of the terrible timing of its release, but I remember having very fond memories of, and that's Space Camp. That Kelly Preston was in. Yeah, the movie that came out, like, I think a couple months after the Challenger explosion. But she has this fun, you know, sort of, she's part of the main cast. She's like this valley girl who has a surprising amount of intelligence, and she has an eidetic memory and things like that. And there's just ways in which she always like lifted up these small roles with that brightness and that beautiful smile and those big expressive eyes. And like, yeah, there was just always something really, really endearing about her. And I think, you know, to an extent, you know, we don't really talk as much about like the Scientology stuff as we would normally do on maybe a podcast more suited to like these stars. But I don't know. It's very interesting to think about them in the prism of this kind of system. But yeah, I think for what it's worth, in the kind of, you know, dynamic that they had, it seemed like they were that they were very close and they loved each other. And it's I don't know. It's a real loss.
No. Just real quickly, just like they say for me, Kelly Preston was there was a point, you know, you just mentioned Space Camp, but there was a point in the 80s that if you saw Kelly Preston in a film, you know she was going to a deflower version at some point. It's just like, there was like a nice run where she was just like... the flowering version. So like he elevated to an art form in the even in Twins. Like people forget that Arnold Schwarzenegger was a virgin in Twins. So it's just like, yeah, he's like, he's kind of like, you know, that one of those first crush actresses where it's just like a lot of guys saw her in a movie and just that was the first crush on her.
I remember when I was a video store clerk, the video box for Mischief, which was her falling out of a 1950s car with like some preppy on top of her. It made a very indelible impression on my
mind. Right.
Like, I must see this magical movie someday. And I never actually did. But again, I think there was just, she was luminescent.
Yeah.
And it's a tricky thing when people keep their battles with fatal illness private, you know. In my piece, I said this was something that sort of Gene Wilder and David Bowie did as well. And on one hand, you appreciate it, and you don't want to spend the last 6 months of your life being like, "So, what's it like having a fatal illness?" Or like, "What are you going to say to your, you know, what's your?"
You know, you don't want to be gawked at.
Oh, totally. You know, but at the same time, like, you kind of, it gives you time to come to terms with that, you know, to process it, to you know, kind of prepare for the inevitable day when this horrible thing will happen. And when you wake up in the morning and you say, "Kelly Preston dead," it's like, oh my God, I had no idea. And again, I think because she was so beautiful, I literally thought she'd be one of those people where it's like, you know, the girl from Jerry Maguire, look how amazing she looks at 80. You know, yeah, 57 is just so young. You know, and she was such a young presence. She also was in a lot of her husband's worst movies, which is really saying something when you're married to John Travolta. But yeah, The Experts, Battlefield Earth, Old Dogs, and Gaudi.
Yeah, they kind of had that Kirk Cameron thing.
They were for four from hell. But yeah, I think that speaks to her being a very supportive partner. Because Gaudi, from what I heard, was like a big. God, and now the director of Gaudi has been accused of sexual assault.
So that movie, is that surprising, though, really?
No, God, oh God, no at all.
Yeah.
But she definitely was there for her husband in whatever ridiculous, stupid movie he wanted her to appear in. And yeah, it was always great to see her on screen.
And if that's not love, I don't know what is.
Definitely.
All right. Well, I think we're reaching the end of this episode of Travolta Cage. Craig, thank you so much once again for coming on the show. I really, really appreciate it. It was a blast to have you on.
Well, as I tell all the people who let me on their podcast, thank you for letting me curse for like an hour.
Anything we can do in this pandemic to make us feel better. Do you want to tell the people once again where they can find your stuff?
Once again, I'll make this quick. Is at UNCLE CRIZZLE. Yeah, I got it now. You can go on to Twitter and then Instagram, and I'm on Byte. I don't know what that is. Just look for myself in Houston Chronicle, Culture Map, Houston, Crooked Marquee, Natural Scene. And don't forget my podcast, Everything Is Canceled. It's you can just like go on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Anchor, wherever. So that's where it's at.
I want to put in a plug for the 500-page extended version of my book, The Word According to Al, which should be available for purchase on Amazon and my website, nathanraven.com/shop. It's 500 pages, all about Weird Al Yankovic, his complete discography, his movies, his TV shows. I wrote about every single episode of The Weird Al Show. I wrote about every single episode of his season of Comedy Bang Bang. I wrote about his 2018 tour. It is literally 500 pages of literary glory, and it should be out by the time this episode drops, which I'm very, very excited. The Weird According to Al, the ridiculously self-indulgent, ill-advised vanity edition.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much for listening to this episode of Travolta Cage. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, whatever your podcast platform may be. You can find us on Twitter at Travolta Cage. I'm on Twitter at Clint Worthing. Nathan, you're on Twitter at Nathan Raben. You can find the episodes at nathanraben.com in blog post form. You can send us messages that we will eventually read on travoltacagepod@gmail.com. You can support us by going to patreon.com/travoltacage. Thank you so much for listening. And now, if you'll excuse me, I gotta go poop.